thankful for that. What is the first time you recall getting into a fight with someone? How old were you? Who was it with? The first time you remember getting into a fight. I was 7 or 8 years old. Third grade, Mrs. Cook's class. I was a good student and never got in trouble. I was almost a goody two-shoes in school. Outside of school was a different story. I liked to be rough and tough, kind of a part of a neighborhood gang. But from 9 in the morning to 3 in the afternoon, an angel. After the bell rang and we left school, Mr. Hyde would appear. My teachers would have fainted had they seen some of the things I did and said after school. But on one occasion, Mr. Hyde showed up at school. It was Halloween of 1967. All the children were invited to come to school in costume. My two favorite television shows in those days was the Red Skelton Show and Daniel Boone. And I had the world's greatest Daniel Boone costume made by my grandmother with an authentic coonskin cap from Cherokee, North Carolina. I was the real deal. And so I went to school that fateful day dressed as Daniel Boone. I was Daniel Boone. Now, I loved Mrs. Cook. She was a wonderful teacher, beautiful lady, classy and nice. I had been an angel all the time and would never want to do anything to disappoint her. But on Halloween costume day in 1967, Mrs. Cook had to go out of the room for a few minutes. I don't know why. I'm sure she wasn't planning to be away long. I'm sure she thought everything would be fine for the students for just a few minutes in the classroom. But there happened to be a boy in the class who came to school that day dressed as a Native American. Or as Dan'l would say, an Injun. Now that shouldn't have been a problem because Dan'l's best friend was an Injun, a Cherokee named Mingo. They were best friends, inseparable. But apparently the third grade Native American wasn't Cherokee. He was Shawnee. And he was wearing war paint. He came up to me and said that Indians could beat Daniel Boone. I strongly disagreed. And we kept arguing about it, going back and forth, becoming more and more demonstrative with our words, when all of a sudden, the spirit of Daniel Boone possessed me. And the next thing I know, we were wrestling together. And I then decided to get very creative, as Daniel Boone would do, and stand on top of the desk, on top of a table, and jump onto the engine, just as I had seen Dan'l do in one of the episodes. It wasn't long before I pinned the Shawnee on his back, with me sitting on top of him, and that's when Mrs. Cook re-entered the room. You should have seen the expression on her face. My cover was blown. I was incredibly embarrassed. And I can't remember what happened next, but I'm sure Tonto and I had to take a trip to the principal's office. That, of course, was a silly, silly fight I should have never gotten into. Childish. But the next fight I got into was a little more complex. It was a couple of years later, now 10 or 11 years old, in the fifth grade. My best friend was a boy named Robert Humphrey, and we were like Daniel and Mingo, Batman and Robin, inseparable. Robert was a year older than me, but a lot smaller, shorter, and much, much, much thinner. A little guy. And one afternoon, a boy in our neighborhood named Joey, who was known to be a bit of a bully, started picking on Robert. Joey was big and strong, and little Robert was doing his best to defend himself, and I finally had had enough of Robert being mistreated, so I stood in between them and said that famous line, "Joey, how about picking on someone your own size?" Well, guess what? Joey didn't mind picking on someone his own size, and we went at it. It was a lot tougher fight than the one with the Shawnee. It ended in pretty much of a draw, but I had scrapes and bruises and a limp for a week. Today's lectionary text is probably the most demanding, the most challenging of all of Jesus' teachings. You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, but I say to you, do not resist one who is evil. Whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn the other to them also. If anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, let them have your coat also. Whoever forces you to go 1 mile, go with them too. Give to him who asks of you, and do not turn away from him who wants to borrow from you. You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies. Love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. Be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. So challenging are these words that they have mostly been ignored by Christians and by the church. It's as though we think Jesus must have been tired or something when he said them. Wasn't thinking straight, a little delirious. Mahatma Gandhi said, "The only people on earth who do not see Christ and his teachings as nonviolent are Christians. And if all Christians acted like Christ, the whole world would be Christian," he said. I mean, we can see how Jesus' words relate to the silly little ego fight I got into in the third grade with the Shawnee. That was senseless. But not so much the fight in the fifth grade when I was trying to stick up for a friend who had been bullied and mistreated. That bully deserved a good whooping. In this case, and in many other situations we can think of when people are getting hurt and taken advantage of, Jesus' words just don't make sense to us. I have come to love and to cherish the concept of a holy fool. Not just because a holy fool happens to be our church logo, but because it expresses what Jesus taught and how he lived. The holy fool rides into Roman-occupied Jerusalem on a donkey, claiming that God is king, not Caesar. The holy fool personifies the writings of the Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians when he devotes a long passage explaining that God's ways seem foolish to the world. Google, look up holy fool sometime and read about its meaning and its rich history from the prophets in the Hebrew scriptures with their strange behavior to Jesus and his upside down thinking and teachings, to the monks like St. Francis of Assisi who gave away their possessions and entered monasteries. It's a rich history, the holy fool. On one hand, we like being a holy fool. We understand that Jesus' teachings are filled with wisdom and irony, and they should be followed. But this, today's passage, Jesus has gone too far. It just doesn't make sense. If people take advantage of us once, what's to stop them doing it again and again and again? Aren't we an easy target, a pushover? I can't be that much of a holy fool. I don't believe Jesus said these things just to get us ripped off or exploited or beat up. I believe he said them because it's the only way for there to be change. The only way there to be transformation, life. In that same letter to the Corinthians where Paul talks about being fools for Christ, he says, I preach Christ crucified. I preach Christ crucified. Now that's an interesting choice of words. I preach Christ crucified. If I had been the number one salesman for early Christianity, I would have preached what? Christ resurrected. Why in the world is he preaching Christ crucified? Why is he focusing on the bad news? Because the bad news is really the good news. The only way we can experience a resurrection is to die. And our entire Christian journey, our path on this planet, is about learning how to die. In fact, if you do it well, when you finally have to make your physical transition, it will be a breeze for you. Learning how to die so we may have life. It's a continued dying and rising process. Nothing positive came out of the fight I had with the Shawnee. We had to take a trip to the principal's office. He and I never spoke again. Nothing positive came out of the fight with Joey 2 years later. The only thing we each got out of it were a lot of injuries. Our friendship was harmed. A wall went up between us. Nothing positive came out from it other than maybe Robert not getting beat up. But I'm sure my coming to his rescue did nothing for his self-esteem. But if I had responded with love, which as Preston reminded us at a group on Saturday, is God. If I had responded with love, if I had responded with God, I would have been planting the possibility of something positive happening. I would have been planting the possibility of transformation, of change, of friendship, of life. What Jesus is articulating here is a way of living in the world without violence, a way of overcoming domination in all of its forms by using a way that will not create new forms of violence. He calls us to live generously, to be change makers by living the servant life he had. By the way, a part of the passage that people tend to struggle with is this part that says, be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect. It's such a shame that it's often translated that way. The word perfect here could be better understood as meaning mature. Be mature. Be whole. Be complete. Be mature, Billy, not the third grader or the fifth grader. You're not in the third or fifth grades anymore. Be, as the Message Bible translates it, grow up. Grow up. You're kingdom subjects. You're children of God. Live out your God-created identity. Do not let another person's reaction determine your reaction. That's immature. If you do that, they are actually controlling you. If their actions determine how you respond. And know that it's more important to be loving than to be right. We often hear Dr. Phil say, do you want to be happy or you want to be right? Take it a step further. Jesus would say, know that it's more important to be loving than to be right. The story has often been told, but it's one that can't be repeated enough. In 1946, there were 400 players in Major League Baseball, all of them white. In 1947, there were 399 white players in the major leagues, one of them black, Jackie Robinson. This breakthrough happened mainly because of two men, Robinson, of course, and Branch Rickey, president of the Brooklyn Dodgers. Branch Rickey was known for his wisdom, his great mind, his great intellect. In fact, he's the one credited with developing the farm system in baseball. If you're not familiar with the farm system, it was the belief that milking cows could greatly strengthen a pitcher's throwing arm, and tossing bales of hay could benefit a batter's swing. So professional baseball players were taught to milk cows and toss bales of hay. And Branch Rickey discovered this, and all of these, what they call baseball farms, sprung up all over the country. We didn't know about that, eh? I'm just teasing. That's not what the farm system is. The farm system is the minor league system. I just wanted to make sure you were still listening and that you still had your thinking caps on. Think, right? Question. I can be wrong, right? Anyway, Branch Rickey became known for his exceptional intelligence and for his great faith. People would say his religion was not a coat he put on and took off at night. It was a part of his skin, and he took it with him wherever he went. With his intelligence, wisdom, and faith, Rickey became known throughout baseball as the Mahatma. Rickey knew that the man who could break through the color barrier would not only have to be a really good baseball player, he'd also have to be an incredibly strong person. And when looking through the files of different black players, he felt led to selecting Jack Roosevelt Robinson. Rickey knew that Jackie was not only a good player, he strongly opposed segregation. Rickey was met with opposition by his advisors, his assistants. They told him it would never work. And then Rickey said, Robinson's a Methodist. I'm a Methodist. God's a Methodist. We can't go wrong. Branch Rickey was indeed Methodist. In fact, did you know his whole name was Wesley Branch Rickey? And he went to Wesleyan College. Jackie Robinson was also indeed Methodist. In his youth, he came under the influence of a dynamic and caring minister named Carl Everett Downs of Scott Methodist Church. And it was through Reverend Downs' ministry that Jackie started realizing the true significance of his faith. He was a youth. He was about to get in a lot of trouble because he was so against the laws of the day. Would have gotten in a lot of trouble. But Reverend Downs took this youth under his arm and coached him. And because of that, faith in God began to register with Jack as both a mysterious force beyond his comprehension and as a pragmatic way to negotiate in the world, a new measure of emotional and spiritual poise that he had never known entered his life. And he discovered that he was a child of God and no one and no challenge, however brutal and dehumanizing, could take that away from him, that he was a child of God. Well, on August 28, 1945, Branch Rickey and Jackie Robinson met for the first time. And Rickey offers him a position on the team and a good salary to go along with it. And then Rickey adds, there's one condition. I know you can hit behind the runner, and you can read a pitcher, you can steal bases. The question is, can you control your temper? Robinson stood up and said, you want a player who doesn't have the guts to fight back? And Rickey says, no, I want a player who has the guts not to fight back. Caught up now in the drama, Rickey stripped off his coat and enacted out a variety of parts that portrayed examples of an offended Jim Crow. Now he was a white hotel clerk, rudely refusing Jackie accommodations. Then a supercilious white waiter in a restaurant. Then a brutish railroad conductor. He became a foul-mouthed opponent, Jackie recalled, talking about my race, my parents, in language that was almost unendurable. Now he was a vengeful base runner, vindictive spikes flashing in the sun, sliding into Jackie's black flesh. How do you like that, boy? At one point, Rickey swung his pudgy fist at Jackie's head. Above all, he insisted, Jackie could not strike back. He could not explode in righteous indignation. Only then would this experiment be likely to succeed, and other black men would follow in Robinson's footsteps. Turning the other cheek, Rickey would have him remember, was not proverbial wisdom, but the law of the New Testament. The law of Christ. As one Methodist believer to another, Rickey offered Jackie an English translation of Giovanni Papini's book, Life of Christ, and pointed to what Papini called the most stupefying of Jesus' revolutionary teachings. Ye've heard that it has been said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, but I say to you that you resist no evil. But whoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to them the other also. People aren't going to like this, Branch Rickey said to Jackie. They're going to do anything to get you to react. Echo a curse with a curse, and they'll only hear yours. Follow a blow with a blow, and they'll say, the Negro lost his temper. The Negro does not belong. Your enemy will be out in force, and you cannot meet him on his own low ground. Like our Savior, you've got to have the guts to turn the other cheek. Can you do it? You give me the uniform, Robinson said. You give me a number on my back. And I'll give you the guts. I want to conclude by reading the passage one more time to you. I'm going to use the Message translation, which is a wonderful, wonderful translation for this particular passage. Hear it again with new ears and eyes and hearts. Here's another old saying that deserves a second look. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth. Is that going to get us anywhere? Here's what I propose. Don't hit back at all. If someone strikes you, stand there and take it. If someone drags you into court and sues for the shirt off your back, gift wrap your best coat and make a present of it. And if someone takes unfair advantage of you, use the occasion to practice the servant life. No more tit for tat stuff. Live generously. You're familiar with the old written law, love your friend, and its unwritten companion, hate your enemy. I'm challenging that. I'm telling you to love your enemies. Let them bring out the best in you, not the worst. When someone gives you a hard time, respond with the energies of prayer. For then you are working out of your true selves, your God-created selves. This is what God does. God gives His best. The sun to warm and to rain to nourish. To everyone, regardless, the good and the bad, the nice and the nasty. If all you do is love the lovable, do you expect a bonus? Anybody can do that. If you simply say hello to those who greet you, do you expect a medal? Any run-of-the-mill sinner does that. In a word, what I'm saying is, grow up. You're kingdom subjects. Now live like it. Live out your God-created identity. Live generously and graciously toward others. The way God lives toward you.